have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hand him on my wall.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is John Olbrants. He's the Mary Beth Collins Director of the Hallie Ford Museum of Art in Salem at Willamette University. And he's here to talk about the current show, A Contemporary Bestiary. Welcome to KBOO, John.
Thanks, Joseph. It's great to be here.
The show is images of animals, to put it simply. It's a group show. Some of the artists have more than one piece. Just tell me about one of the first pieces you see. It's a Robert Macaulay piece called Edge of Town.
Edge of Town. Well, it's become sort of the signature piece of the exhibition, in large part because it depicts an owl, a turtle, a squirrel, a bear, a pelican, a deer, a moose. So in a sense, it sort of summarizes the whole notion of what a bestiary is. Bestiary essentially is a compendium of animals and legends and fables associated with those animals. So we kind of felt that Bob's piece, who ironically or coincidentally I went to college with a zillion years ago, we kind of felt that it summarized the nature of the exhibition.
Do you know why he painted it? A collection of animals, you know, that would never be seen together.
Well,
sort of posing.
Yeah, he in recent years, Bob has focused a lot on animal imagery, in large part because he sees a lot of species dying out, and so he likes to call attention to them. He wants to be able to record them for posterity. So in Bob's case, you know, he's very, very environmentally conscious. And
that was an oil painting. But then in one of the rooms, dominating the rooms, is a horse.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
By Deborah Butterfield. The piece is called Red Forest. It was made last year. And it's cast bronze with patina. So she's constructed a horse out of pieces of wood and, you know, it looks like a roughly sketched drawing, but it's a huge life-size horse.
It does.
And some of the pieces holding it up are just pieces of tree, you know, with twigs coming off them. People might know her piece from outside the Portland Art Museum. It's the same idea. It's a horse. It looks like driftwood, but it's actually cast
right.
in bronze.
Yeah, she's Deborah Butterfield's been making horses like this piece, which is called Red Forest, for a good 30 years. She, Debbie Butterfield, loves horses, and she loves the humanity of horses. She loves everything about horses. She initially constructs her horse sculptures out of pieces of scrap wood. So they might have several hundred pieces of scrap wood that she collects and has laying around. And she assembles these horses either standing, recumbent, in different poses. She constructs them out of wood. And once she's happy with the wood sculpture, she numbers the individual pieces of wood and then disassembles the sculpture, takes the individual pieces of wood to her foundry in Walla Walla, the Walla Walla foundry, and they cast each of those individual pieces in bronze. Once those pieces are cast in bronze, they're reassembled, rewelded into the final sculpture. I was talking to one of the people that helped bring it down, who works at the Walla Walla Foundry. He said that the piece, one of these pieces, takes a minimum of 1,000 hours to cast and then to reassemble. It's quite a labor-intensive process, and it's not just one person working on this. It's the whole, you know, there's a whole team of foundry workers working on each individual piece. So
she, Deborah Butterfield, has another horse in the show, actually, and it's made of metal.
Yes.
Sort of like flat steel. It reminded me of a bed frame. It's that sort of brown flat steel.
Yeah, it's just, it's thicker. Scrap steel that she has. And she just bends the steel and creates this. In that case, it's a recumbent horse.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible. It looks like a sketch, a beautiful fluid sketch.
Yeah, her work.
But it's all done by bending steel. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know how she does it, but
yeah, the work. You know, all of her works have that very sort of linear quality to them, which mm-hmm. is quite wonderful.
There's a piece which looks very kind of Portlandy, actually, the kind of thing you'd see in a boutique or a bar around here on East Burnside. It's Rachel Denny's Blush, and it's a deer with antlers covered in pink, what looks like crochet.
Yeah.
Everything has been tailored, so the patterns all line up, and and it's this sort of tailored pink trophy.
Do
you think she was up to in that?
I don't know. I discovered her work while perusing the Foster White Gallery's website up in Seattle, and I was delighted to know that she was actually an Oregon artist. And she's been doing these sort of animal trophy heads for a number of years. She's been working full-time as an artist for the last 3 or 4 years. Prior to that, she worked as a preparator at the Portland Art Museum. And then we have another piece. It's a llama made out of, it's almost like a shag carpet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's multi-
green wool.
Green wool, right. And it's actually multicolored, but the predominant color is green. So I think I haven't really talked to Rachel in depth about these pieces, but I believe a lot of what she's sort of getting at is just the way we sort of historically have abused animals and hunted them and placed their severed heads on homes and walls.
There's a piece called by Rick Bartow, Big Bear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of classic Bartow, a lot of violent looking colors going on, some deep blacks, a blue outline. It's a bear, it could be a monkey as well, and it's pretty dramatic. It's a big acrylic canvas.
I think certainly one of Oregon's significant artists. And we have a large body of work by Rick in our collection because he's essentially a neighbor. He lives at Newport on the Oregon coast.
Mm-hmm.
And in putting the exhibition together, I wanted to make sure that we had a nice balance of artists from Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and British Columbia. And so Rick was an artist who I immediately wanted to include in the exhibition. Rick is very much a contemporary painter, but he's Native American. He's Wiat, which is a tribe on the southwest Oregon coast, northwest California coast. And his work is a really interesting sort of blend of very, very much contemporary imagery with Native American mythology. And a lot of his work deals with transformation. And transformation myths, and it's very, as you say, it's very, very personal. It's very, a lot of it's very angry. Rick is a pretty joyful person, but he has come from an angry place. He was a Vietnam vet and suffered, survivor's guilt. He, also has, battled his own demons, as we all have in our lifetimes, and has, but through that whole process has really transformed himself.
How did you get this 2014 painting? Did you just ask for it?
Well, it's funny. I Charles Froelich at the Froelich Gallery is another good friend, and I was in the gallery and saw these two. There's actually another piece by Rick of Crow. I said, Charles, we've got to have those pieces in the exhibition. And he said, I told him about the exhibition. He said, absolutely. So he held them
exhibition.
They're actually loans from the gallery.
They haven't been bought yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. So
that's how it works. It's sort of, you've got a big theme. Animals.
Yeah.
How do you just tap into your friends and colleagues?
Yeah, you sort of begin with your checklist of artists, artists that you'd like to include. you find works by them that are sort of indicative of their work, and you select work by them for your exhibition, and then you sort of, you know, in my case, I began going to websites and following up on leads for artists that, you know, I might not know about, and gather information that way. And then, you know, once you have this large stockpile of information, you begin to kind of hone it down.
Mm-hmm. The piece Halibut, mm-hmm. Robert Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
It's a serigraph. What is a serigraph?
It's a print. It's essentially like a silk screen print.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert is probably Canada's most certainly one of Canada's, if not Canada's most important Indigenous artists. He was born on Haida Gwaii, which we know is the Queen Charlotte Islands, but they the Haida refer to it as Haida Gwaii. He moved to Vancouver in the late 1960s to study with the great Canadian Indigenous artist Bill Reid, and worked with Bill Reid, and began making prints, and began carving masks, very traditional Haida prints and masks in the 70s. And by the early 80s, as an artist in his early to mid 30s, he sort of burst onto the national scene, and you know, his work has just gotten stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And in addition to being a fabulous printmaker and carver, you know, he's also a fantastic musician and dancer, as you remember, Joseph.
He did the mass for the Rainbow Creek Dancers.
He and his brother Reg founded the Rainbow Creek Dancers in 1980 in honor of their grandmother. At the time, a lot of the traditional Haida stories, dances, and songs were being lost. Robert and Reg formed the Rainbow Creek Dancers to preserve that legacy. And we had them at Willamette in early October, and you and your son attended mm-hmm. that performance.
The kind of masks you see in the Portland Art Museum in the native section, mm-hmm. like long beaks that open up with hinges, and there's something else inside.
Right, transformation masks.
Got to see them in real life, brand new, carved, you know, freshly painted.
Right.
In the act of the dance.
Right, being performed.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and so, you know, we wanted to have Rick is a very important Native American artist, working in a very contemporary fashion, although with very traditional imagery. Robert Davidson, by contrast, is another Indigenous artist, but he's working with very traditional Northwest Coast Indian forms and lines and imagery, but dealing with a lot of the same ideas. I mean, mythology and, you know, the role of halibut in culture, the role of, you know, killer whales or bears, and the legends associated with those.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to be able to show both a kind of a traditional as well as non-traditional Indigenous artist.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is John Olbrants. He's the director of the Halle Ford Museum of Art in Salem, and he's here talking about the show A Contemporary Bestiary, which runs there through December 21st. Just say a bit more about the idea of the bestiary.
Well, the bestiary comes from the Latin term bestiarum, which is basically, it's a compendium of legends, fables, moral lessons associated with animals.
So a book.
A book, basically a book, both real as well as supernatural animals.
Was this zoology, the cutting-edge zoology, or was it considered non-scientific?
I'm not sure how scientific it was. I really don't know. It started in the, actually, the bestiarums were were these accumulation of these sort of stories. I mean, think Aesop's Fables is sort of a classic bestiarium, but it's a compendium, as I said, of these lessons, moral lessons associated with animals, and often associated, often accompanied by illustrations. And so, they began in the 3rd, the 2nd century BCE. They really became most popular in medieval Europe in the 11th, 12th, 13th century, where, kings and queens and nobility would have their bestiaries, their illuminated manuscripts of, mm-hmm. Of animal imagery with, appropriate moral lessons, typically written in Latin. So when I was putting this exhibition together, I'm an ancient art historian, actually, by training, although I do a lot of work with contemporary art, so I'm kind of working at both ends of the historical spectrum. When I decided to put this exhibition together, I thought, gee, I couldn't think of a better term than a bestiary, and so the exhibition became a contemporary bestiary.
David Gilhooly, there's a piece by him from 1993, so it's called Frog of Stairs, it's mm-hmm. a pun on Fred Astaire, yep. A bunch of frogs dancing down the stairs with top hats. It's sort of black outlines, pale green, these are hand-colored engravings mm-hmm. with watercolor. Mm-hmm. Who is David Gilhooly? He died in 2013.
Yeah, David was an amazing artist. He was born and raised in California. He went to UC Davis in the 1960s, originally to study. He wanted to be a veterinarian. His father was a veterinarian, and David went there to study veterinary medicine. But he soon fell under the spell of the art department. Robert Arneson, Roy DeForest, Wayne Thiebaud, and other artists were all teaching at Davis at the time. And David switched his major from biology to art, and began working with Robert Arneson in the ceramics department. And wound up getting his BFA and MFA degree at UC Davis in art, and then he stayed on and taught there. David was part of an art movement that sort of rose to prominence in California and on the West Coast in the early 1970s, called the Funk Art Movement. And basically what this group of artists did is they took everyday objects, humble objects, and elevated them to the status of high art. So in David's case, he focused on the humble frog and created a whole alternate universe of frogs. Not only is he a wonderful printmaker, but he's also a fantastic... he was known primarily as a ceramic artist.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't he have a frog Buddha in the show?
Well, that's actually a print, but he has a piece of... it's called Frog Flapjacks. In the exhibition,
yeah.
And then he has another piece of Lewis and Clark and the two frogs. Actually, Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea in the guise of frogs, riding this big arc on this wave, with fish coming up in the wave, and it's really quite a wonderful piece. It's actually a piece that we commissioned David to make a number of years ago. Anyway, he created this whole sort of alternate universe of frog imagery, including a frog as King Tut, a frog as the Mona Lisa, a frog as Queen Victoria. He also was fascinated by fast food, and so there's often a lot of food imagery in his work. He was really a funny artist, irreverent, subversive. A great artist. He quit making ceramics in the 1980s because he got just sick and tired of it, and started working in plexiglass and plastic.
Would you call him a Would he have thought of himself as a pop artist at the time?
Oh, yeah, very. I think pop artist, a humorist, sort of a subversive.
Do you think his work will end up in museums and be taken terribly seriously?
Oh, it already is, and we've he's been included in a number of major ceramics surveys, along with Robert Arneson and others. And David passed away in 2013. He moved to Oregon. He and his wife Camille moved, and their boys lived in Dayton initially, and then moved to Newport. So he was here for a long time. We mounted sort of a major survey exhibition of his plexiglass and plastic work in 2000. And after David died, I told his widow Camille that I wanted to sometime. Within the next 5 or 6 years, I want to mount a major retrospective for him of his not only his ceramic work but his prints as well as his plexi and plastic work.
Around the top of the gallery, there's strings of words, and they're the collective nouns for animals, mm-hmm. also known as terms of venery. So things like a murder of crows.
Mm-hmm.
Pack of dogs,
right,
and then
right.
Some of them are just completely new to me. Do you remember any of them?
Well, there's an exaltation of larks.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a hybrid of hippos, something like that? I don't know them all, but terms of venery were apparently originally medieval hunting terms. The humorist and writer James Lipton, a number of years ago, wrote a book where he. I think he started with those as sort of a basis and then elaborated on them and came up with, published a book called An Exaltation of Larks,
mm-hmm.
which includes a number of the original terms of venery, as well as, I believe, new terms that he came up with.
The rest of the show, there's just so much stuff. There's
Alfred Ottegien.
Wonderful,
good friend of mine. I've known Alfredo. I met Alfredo at the Blue Moon Tavern in Seattle in 1974. So I've known him for a long time.
So you have a big painting called Tula, which is monkeys up a tree.
Yeah, Tula. Alfredo is a Mexican-American painter. He was born and raised in Mexico. His father was an architect, an engineer. Sent Alfredo to work in the jungles as a young teenager. And Alfredo has always had a real affinity for the jungle and for the flora and fauna of the Central American jungle. He immigrated to the United States in the late 50s, early 60s, went to the University of Washington, and has been a major painter for the past 40 years in Seattle, internationally recognized. One of the ideas behind the exhibition was to create an exhibition that not only was geographically diverse, I wanted to make sure that the exhibition had good gender balance, that we had artists of color represented, that there was a balance in terms of age. So we have artists like Galen Hansen, who's been making these big raw paintings of animals Well, he's 92 years old. And he's been making these kinds of works for at least 40 or 50 years. Two younger, kind of emerging artists like Rachel Denny from Oregon and Justin Givens from Washington, who's actually represented by the Elizabeth Leach Gallery. So we wanted to make sure it was well balanced on a number of different levels, and we also wanted to make sure that the artists included in the exhibition that we had a wide variety of different themes kind of playing out. Some of the artists use animals to address environmental and ecological issues. Some use animals for humor. Some use animals because they just really, really like them.
Mm-hmm.
Some use animals as a reflection of, their personal states of mind.
Then you've got a couple of great shows coming up. Roger Shimamura.
Mm-hmm.
He is a Japanese American painter and printmaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
his work is just amazing. sort of pop art, you know, and looks like cartoons, mm-hmm. and he's dealing with Japanese issues, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Well, he is. Roger is, he's an artist who sort of straddles a couple of different geographic regions of the United States. He was born and raised in Seattle, born in 1939 in Seattle. He spent his early childhood at Minidoka concentration camp in Idaho, where he and his family was interned.
Yeah, one of these images is so amazing. It's called Classmates, number one. It's mm-hmm. two young women eating apples in their sort of 1940s dresses, smiling, but they're separated by barbed wire. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not cattle barbed wire, it's human. Mm-hmm. Barbed wire fence for humans is very high.
Mm-hmm. And the woman behind the barbed wire is Japanese-American. The woman in front of the barbed wire is sort of a classic blonde, blue-eyed American girl. And the title of the work is Classmates Number One. So Roger spent his childhood at Minidoka and then went back to Seattle. He eventually went on and got his undergraduate degree, his BA degree at the University of Washington, went on to Syracuse University, where he received his MFA degree in studio art. And from 1969 to, I think, 2004, he taught at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, but always maintained real strong ties to the Pacific Northwest. His family is still, much of his family is still here, and so he sort of divides his time between Lawrence, Kansas, and Seattle, Washington. And a lot of his work combines sort of a childhood interest in comic books with American pop art and Japanese ukiyo-e, or, you know, woodblock prints, pictures of the floating world.
There's one, Night Watch, Minidoka.
Minidoka, yes.
It looks like a Chris Ware picture. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's illuminated windows in an apartment building with silhouette people. But it's so clean and contemporary looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was made last year. How old is he now?
Roger is 75, mm-hmm. 76 years old. A lot of his work over the years has dealt with his experiences and his memories of Minidoka and what that did to Japanese Americans and how they were able to survive being interned for a couple of years. At the same time, a lot of his work deals with what it's like being an Asian American in the United States in the 1950s and 60s. You know, as he says, Seattle is a very diverse city, ethnically diverse, but he said he spent the majority of his life in the Midwest where, you know, being Japanese American or Asian American is sort of an anomaly.
So one show is Works on Paper that begins November the 8th and goes through February 1st.
Yes.
And the other show is the bigger one, Roger Shimomura, An American Knockoff.
And that opens January 17th and runs through March 29th.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week was John Olbrants. He's the director of the Hallie Ford Museum of Art at Willamette University in Salem. And the show he was talking about is called A Contemporary Bestiary, and it runs through December 21st. Thanks for coming into KBOO, John.
Thank you, Joseph. It's great to be here.
Thank you. addition to being weird, Portland is becoming known in the tech industry as a city that fosters innovation. Many people working in the industry believe that new technology can solve problems, including social and environmental problems. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Disruptive Technologies and Human Design, part 4 of Startup City, How the New Tech Boom is Changing Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Lisa Loving, Delphine Crescenzo, and Don Merrill will host 3 hours of talk about the elections from the KBOO perspective and include special guests, KBOO reporters in the field, and members of Oregon community media phoning in from all over the state. We'll talk candidates, measures, winners-losers, voter disenfranchisement, and more. Again, that's Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.